to Dayan Against the Grain. The influential scholar Cedric Robinson had a lot to say about hierarchy, culture, the so-called world system, and the Black radical tradition. I'm CS. UC Irvine professor Yusuf Al-Balushi describes and interprets Robinson's ideas and perspectives coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Cedric Robinson is one of those tremendously influential thinkers who are not widely known. A political scientist and Black Studies scholar who spent the majority of his career at UC Santa Barbara, Cedric Robinson advanced notions of racial capitalism and the Black radical tradition that not only resonate in academic circles, but also inform activists and agitators on the ground. Robinson lived from 1940 to 2016. His best-known book is Black Marxism, The Making of the Black Radical Tradition. Yusuf Al-Balushi wrote an article about Cedric Robinson's thought with a focus on the role that Africa and African studies played in how Robinson came to think about culture, politics, the world system, and Black radicalism. Yusuf Al-Balushi is assistant professor of global and international studies at UC Irvine. The article, which appeared in the journal GeoForum, has the title Thinking Racial Capitalism and Black Radicalism from Africa, an intellectual geography of Cedric Robinson's world system. When Yusuf and I connected recently, I asked about a trip Robinson took to Africa while in college.
This seems to have been a very formative trip for Cedric Robinson. He went with a group called Operation Crossroads Africa, which was organized by a kind of Pan-Africanist Reverend James Robinson. And it was quite a large group. This was in 1962, I believe, during his senior year at UC Berkeley. And the group was almost 300 people from North America, Mexico, US, and Canada. And it's kind of a cross-cultural exchange, in part, I believe, supported by the US government, but also organized by people who had these Pan-Africanist political leanings. So you could see it as almost like a younger person's version of what became the Peace Corps. And he traveled to a number of countries, including Kenya, where apparently he had the opportunity to meet Jomo Kenyatta, and spent a number of weeks in what was Southern Rhodesia, later became known as Zimbabwe, doing kind of volunteer projects, building homes, building a school, building for local communities, and then just interacting with people. And when he came back from that trip, he wrote a short reflection in the local newspaper, the Sun Reporter. It appeared in December of 1962, just a short piece called How Is It in Southern Rhodesia? And you get some sense of his interest in everyday life in Africa, certainly his interest in the anti-colonial movements, his interest in the globality of racism, right? You couldn't imagine a kind of more segregated racist society than Southern Rhodesia, in which a small minority of white settlers really had a lot of power and would go on to declare unilateral independence just for the white settler government within a couple years of Cedric Robinson having been there. But you get a sense of how, as a young man, he was keenly attentive to African cultural practices already, the kinds of communities that he visited with, and the kind of identification that he felt with these people which perhaps might not have been too different from his identification with his own recent ancestors, his grandfather, who was really played an important role in his upbringing and in his kind of moral and political compass, someone who had escaped the U.S. South and its own racisms and had moved west out to Oakland, where Cedric Robinson was born. So it was fascinating to me that he went to Africa at such a young age. He would have been about 22 when he went, and that he went with this Pan-African group, that he met political leaders, extremely important political leaders, but that also in his own reflections on the trip, you can glean a sense of his own third worldism. He in this piece that he wrote in the Sun Reporter, How Is It in Southern Rhodesia, he's really making an appeal that is an asking rhetorical questions like, will the UN understand the pleas of the blacks in the townships of Makakoba, Mzilikazi, and Mpopoma outside the city of Bulawayo, where most often 3 to 4 families must stay in one room the size of your kitchen? Will the UN understand the pleas of the tens of thousands of unemployed because they're not educated, uneducated because they are unemployed, both because they are black? So you see a sense of his understanding of the overlappings of race and class, a sense in this rhetorical question that the United Nations may not be an adequate vehicle for African and third world liberation, and a sense that the struggle in Africa is bound not up with the African diaspora, but with the entire third world, as people of color confronting a kind of global white supremacy and imperialism. So all of these themes emerge in this early reflection that he publishes in the Sun Reporter after this trip.
And then Cedric Robinson decides to go to graduate school. He applies for a PhD program in political science, gets accepted to Stanford, and he obviously goes there to study political science, but he also goes there to do something to the discipline of political science, which is what?
He goes there basically to destroy what they stand for, which in his mind, in less rhetorical terms, is to question the unstated assumption behind the discipline of political science. And as he saw it, those unstated assumptions that went unquestioned in the discipline of political science were a sense of the necessity for order, an assumption that all societies required authority figures, structures, and therefore that they required leadership, and that these attributes of order, authority, and leadership were the central attributes of what's known as the political, any understanding of politics. So he announces to his new department and advisors that that's his mission. He's coming in to really question these unstated assumptions of the discipline. And you can imagine that that doesn't go over very well with many of the professors of political science. So he writes a dissertation that later becomes a book, is published in 1980, called The Terms of Order, Political Science, and the Myth of Leadership. And you can see that even though it's quite an academic study, it's profoundly shaped by, and it must have been profoundly shaped by, his own reading of the movements of the 1960s and 70s. Both those movements he interacted with in Africa, the anti-colonial struggles, and then similarly back in the United States, the civil rights, black power, women's liberation struggles that we're undergoing, and his own sense of both skepticism of leadership, the role of leadership in these movements. We can think of Fanon's critique of the national bourgeoisie in the context of anti-colonial movements and the role they come to play. And back in the United States, we have a sense that Cedric Robinson must be seeing some of the pitfalls of that top-down form of political organizing, but also that top-down mode of understanding the significance of these movements insofar as we tend to personify them, read them through great figures like Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, rather than through the eyes of everyday people that I think Cedric Robinson was most interested in.
My guest is Yusuf Al-Balushi. He teaches in the Department of Global and International Studies at UC Irvine, and his work focuses on political theory, global political economy, African and African diaspora studies, critical theories of space and social movements in Africa and the Americas. I came across an article he wrote for the journal GeoForum about the thought of Cedric Robinson. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So Cedric Robinson's distaste for authority and leadership, I mean, this smacks of anarchism. To what extent did he subscribe to a brand of anarchism? And to what extent did he look to Africa for what you might call an anarchist tradition, maybe not in the Western anarchist sense, but perhaps in some other sense that you might help us understand?
Yeah, that's a really important point, right? Any criticism of leadership, certainly of the state as central to politics, to our understandings of the political, does conjure up the anarchist political tradition. And he does touch on anarchism in his dissertation that became his first book, The Terms of Order. And he discusses it primarily as a Western movement, as a movement that has its origins in Europe. And he clearly has tremendous appreciation for this tradition, insofar as it was, like him, interested in the actions of everyday people, interested in the possibility of people coming together without a hierarchical structure or a leader kind of guiding them or determining what their behavior should look like, interested in transcending the law as something that must be granted from the top down by a state to govern people, to prevent from descending back into supposedly that state of nature that Hobbes and Locke had first theorized as justification for why we need a state, the modern state. So he was very appreciative of anarchism, and he discusses it in positive terms in this book. But he also goes on to argue that Western anarchism is kind of shaped by its own historical and geographical context. And in a sense, he seems to be arguing that it was shaped by that which it resisted, excessively shaped by that which it resisted. So it was bound up with a critique of the state. It was anti-statist because it emerged at a time when the state was gaining ground as the preeminent political structure. And so despite the fact that it sought to overcome the state, it was constantly obsessed and dialectically intertwined with the state. And for that reason, he wants to argue that, you know, maybe there's another window into what he calls non-political societies rather than anti-political societies that might come from, again, the third world, that come from outside Europe, that may not have used the term anarchism, but may have had a sense of community that didn't rely upon the state, not because they were intentionally trying to escape it, but because they had already developed an alternative sociality, an alternative metaphysic of understanding the world that prevented the state from emerging in the first place.
So what's an example of a non-political society in the third world that Cedric Robinson pointed to, that he held up for consideration?
So here he turns to some of the anthropological literature, and you see his debt to the discipline of anthropology. So he had majored in anthropology at UC Berkeley, and he had studied with some of the leading anthropologists, including people like Elizabeth Coulson, I believe, who was an anthropologist based at UC Berkeley, who had written a number of books on the Tonga people, the Ila Tonga people in what is today contemporary Zambia. And Cedric became quite fascinated by these people and by some of the anthropological writings on kind of anti-statist, non-state societies in Africa by writers such as Georges Balandier, the French anthropologist. And so he touches on the Tonga after his discussion of Western anarchism as potentially giving us a different window into a leaderless society. And he acknowledges that the information he has to go on here is limited. He acknowledges that the utility of drawing upon such examples is kind of bracketed by potential limits and preconditions, such as the question of whether the experiences of people living in a rural society in Africa can be transferred to the context of urbanized, industrialized, rationalized, and fully politicized humanity. But nonetheless, he does want to gesture to the way that this particular society, because of the fact that they practiced both virilocality and matrilineality in part, so these are societies in which, you know, married couples reside with or near the husband's parents. That's what virilocality or patrilocality refers to. This is common practice in most of the world, right? You get married and it's expected that the wife will move in with the husband's family. But these societies also practiced matrilineality, right? Matrilineality is a system in where kinship is traced through the female line. So that includes questions of property and inheritance. So this is a kind of countervailing move, which pulls the direction back towards the wives' villages. So what resulted amongst the Ilitonga people, according to the anthropological literature, was kind of these back and forth migrations being pulled in multiple directions of the community towards the husband's family and lineage, and then a countervailing pull towards the wives' family. And this kind of theme and counter theme, as he calls it, yields a multitude of competing, conflictual, demanding allegiances, loyalties, and mores, which he says are a consequence of Tonga metaphysics, economics, and kinship, and forms the matrix of Tonga social stability. As a result of this, he says that you get a kind of principle of incompleteness amongst the Tonga, where instead of humans being understood as they are in the Western tradition, through the lens of notions of individual autonomy and self-determination, sovereign, rational human beings and actors, they are understood through this principle of incompleteness, where no individual or couple is complete without these competing binds to different sides of the family. And in a sense, they operate kind of like checks and balances on power. And according to the anthropological literature, also, it results in a kind of anarchistic society where you don't have centralized authority in what we recognize as states. And instead, this principle of incompleteness is quite compatible with what Western anarchism refers to as mutual aid, as necessary for our survival, right? We rely upon each other in these multiple and overlapping senses of obligation to different parts of the community. So this is his gesture to, again, an African way of understanding the world amongst particular groups that are known as the Ilitonga. And it's his attempt to uncover outside the Western anarchist tradition something that nonetheless complicates it, complements it rather, but is less reliant upon an obsessive rejection of the state, but rather because of its forms of organization and its kinship structure, kind of naturally lends itself to an anti-statist society where there isn't a need for centralized authority and what we would later come to understand as modern states. And in this sense, right, Robinson is looking at an example of something that is similar to what the French theorist and anthropologist Pierre Clastres theorized as society against the state in his own studies of indigenous peoples in South America.
Yusuf Al-Balushi joins us on Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. He is Assistant Professor of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Irvine. We are talking about an article he wrote called Thinking Racial Capitalism and Black Radicalism from Africa, an intellectual geography of Cedric Robinson's world system. It appeared in the journal Geoform, and it examines the thought of the political scientist and Black Studies scholar Cedric Robinson, who wrote, among other books, Black Marxism, The Making of the Black Radical Tradition. That book was published in 1983. The Black Radical Tradition. So this was all important to Cedric Robinson. Did he detect its presence in the Ilatanga people in Zambia? And if so, what connection did he see between that tradition, or what association did he draw between that tradition and a certain kind of democratic governance?
I would say yes, he did, although it's not as explicit in Black Marxism, this link to the Ilatanga, so to speak. But that's part of what I'm hoping to draw, is a link between these studies to point people to his broader work in order to better understand his most famous text that you mentioned, which is Black Marxism, originally published in 1983. And so I think there is a link between his understanding of what he refers to as the Black Radical Tradition, which he's unearthing in Black Marxism. He's trying to point to it as a coherent tradition over time that has its roots in Africa and it spreads throughout the diaspora. So there is a link between that theorization of the Black Radical Tradition in Black Marxism and his earlier discussion of the Ilatanga. And it's the link that you mentioned, which is kind of a notion of radical democracy. And I believe kind of an insistence upon non-sovereignty. It's an anti-statist tradition, if we read him closely. I believe that's what he's arguing throughout his work. And you see this also in later interviews that he did with the Institute for Anarchist Studies in 1999, where he says, fundamentally, the Black radical tradition is democratic. It offers an alternative to hierarchy and a sophisticated critique of the rule of law. Those are all things that he gleaned from his study of the Ilatanga as well. So if we turn to Black Marxism and his discussion of, in part two of the book, of the actual history of the Black radical tradition, the actual existing, what I call the actually existing Black radical tradition. And then in part three of the book, the attempt to theorize that tradition by certain members of the Black intelligentsia. He pays particular attention in this book to the work of W.E.B. Du Bois, C.L.R. James, and Richard Wright. And he argues that they kind of stumbled upon some sense of what the Black radical tradition was and could be, both through their own political work and through their theoretical and historical studies of Black people, right? And then they begin to theorize it in their writings. And so Robinson is offering us a synthesis, in a sense, of the history of the Black radical tradition and of the attempts to theorize that tradition by thinkers like Du Bois, James, and Richard Wright. But he doesn't necessarily give us a fully fleshed out or coherent sense of what is distinct and unique about this Black radical tradition. So that's part of what I wanted to offer with this article, because I think it's more implicit than explicit in some of his writings, and certainly in Black Marxism. But if we link Black Marxism to the terms of order earlier, and then to some of his later writings in the early 1990s, my argument is that we can kind of at least glean some constituent elements of Black radicalism that help us understand, okay, what is this tradition when it comes down to it? How is it similar or different from what we understand radicalism to be writ large. And one of those elements, I would argue, is this insistence upon non-sovereignty, right? Is this insistence upon understanding democracy not as something that can be conferred by a state through representative electoral systems, but as an understanding of democracy as much more radical, wherein people are able to determine their own destiny outside of the state through collective decision-making structures and epistemologies, ways of knowing the world that prevent something like a state from emerging in the first place.
Another constituent element of the Robinsonian Black radical tradition that you identify, and you don't say these are the only elements of what Cedric Robinson came up with, but you do highlight four in this piece, in this journal Geoforum. A second one is a reappreciation of culture and spirituality as key attributes that the Black radical tradition brings to an excessively secular and materialist white Marxism. So he's critiquing a certain kind of European Marxism that he considers too materialist as opposed to cultural and spiritualist, and excessively secular. So elaborate on that. The emphasis that, and the reasoning behind Cedric Robinson's emphasis on culture and spirituality.
Yeah, I think this is crucial for Robinson. And again, as you just put it, it's part of what I think makes the Black radical tradition somewhat unique from certain strains of Marxism or Western radicalism that insisted for their own reasons upon a kind of materialist and secular tradition of struggle, right? It makes sense that those were part of what Western radicalism was fighting against, a fight against the church as a system of knowledge, the aristocracy that was aligned with the church, a fight against a particular philosophy, whether it was Hegel's or others who saw ideas as the central driving force of human history, and an insistence against that on a kind of materialist reading of history, that it's our relationship to our basic material needs of survival, food, clothing, and shelter that form a mode of production and that shape the possibilities for us to shape a different socialistic mode of production according to Marxist understandings of history. So again, Robinson's relationship to that tradition is nuanced and appreciative, but he does think that because of the emphasis upon materialism and secularism, there were times when Western radicalism was unable to understand what was unique about the Black radical tradition and what enabled Black people to mobilize and come together to overthrow something like slavery. So in Black Marxism, you see him studying closely Du Bois's writings on the Civil War and its aftermath in Black Reconstruction in America. And he's very attentive to the fact that Du Bois refers to this moment when enslaved people got up en masse from plantations across the American South and simply left the plantations. Du Bois theorizes this as a general strike. So you can see him inserting into kind of dominant lexicon for what radical struggle looks like, enslaved people as capable of and as having enacted a general strike that paralyzed the South at a crucial moment in the Civil War. And Du Bois attributes the victory of the North over the South not to Lincoln or to the bravery of the Union Army, but to the enslaved people who got up and left the plantation, crippling the South of their labor force, which they needed to provide the Southern Confederate Army with food. And Du Bois also doesn't just insist that this was a general strike. He asks the question, what enabled these enslaved people to come together and to assert their agency across vast distances, right, around the South? What kind of knowledge of the world enabled them to act as one in that moment? And it was not kind of traditionally materialist or secular knowledge. nor was it, as sometimes the Marxist tradition has theorized, their economic position as a proletariat, wherein it was thought that by being brought together under a single factory, the proletariat is forced to cooperate for capital. But this cooperation can also be turned against capitalism, because now, as opposed to being isolated in the countryside as peasants unable to communicate with each other, a proletariat is distinct because they're brought together to cooperate for capital. They can communicate, they're on the factory shop floor, and they can use that cooperation to form a working class that is conscious of itself to overthrow capitalism. But that would be a reading that attributes agency in the working class in some senses to their economic relationship to capitalism. But Robertson says that's not what enabled enslaved people to cooperate. Instead, and he notes Du Bois's mentioning of what enabled them to cooperate, it was an understanding of this moment as the coming of the Lord.
The coming of the Lord, I mean, that really is striking. That is so contrary to any analysis that might point to politics or economics. Yeah, elaborate on that. What did he mean by that?
I think Du Bois here is pointing to the cultural and spiritual reservoir and epistemology that was dominant amongst the enslaved, which allowed them to understand the Civil War, in a sense, as the second coming of Christ. This is a moment to act. Christ is potentially returning. And, you know, because of our spiritual reading of the world, because of our own form of Black Christianity, potentially, right, this was now the moment in which we needed to get up and leave the plantation. Freedom is coming with the second coming of Christ, and we therefore need to get up and join this moment, right? It's a spiritual reading that enables the agency of the enslaved people. Robinson points out something very similar, not just in the American Civil War, but in the Haitian Revolution. And there he's reading C.L.R. James's Black Jacobins, in which you see the way that C.L.R. James, like Du Bois, is forced to do this two-step in relationship to Marxist readings of resistance and working class struggle. On the one hand, they're trying to insert historical Black subjects who have been discounted from the Marxist tradition up to that point as not agentive, as coming out of a pre-capitalist mode of production, as not a part of the working class, necessarily, enslaved people. So they do that by saying, as Du Bois did, these people were engaged in a general strike. Or, as James does, when he writes about the plantation system in Haiti and describes how it was structured, he says explicitly, nowhere else in the world could you have more of a modern proletariat than the enslaved workers on the Haitian plantation. He's trying to get people to read enslaved workers in Haiti as a proletariat. Now, some people have pointed to the ways that he may be stretching the category proletariat there, right, to apply to people working on a plantation agrarian system. But he's trying to do that because he's trying to get his fellow radicals in the Marxist tradition to take historical Black actors as a part of that Marxist tradition. But on the other hand, and this is what Robinson is really interested in, and in C.L.R. James's account of the Haitian Revolution, this attention to culture and spirituality is a little bit more fleeting than it is in Du Bois's account of the Civil War and its aftermath. But even C.L.R. James mentions, when discussing the Haitian Revolution and what made it possible, he uses this phrase saying voodoo was the medium of the conspiracy. In other words, it was enslaved Haitian people's understanding of their culture and spirituality through an Afro-descendant religious practice known as voodoo that enabled the conspiracy amongst them to emerge in the first place and then to continue, right? We all have heard the great stories of one of the early leaders of the Haitian Revolution, Macandal, and the belief amongst the enslaved people that he had the ability to fly, to escape from the white men who ruled the plantations. And his ability to fly meant that he was still conducting the struggle up in the mountains somewhere, right? Even well after he had potentially been defeated. But that belief that he was still out there through this kind of spiritual understanding of who he was and what he was doing is what enabled them to come together as an enslaved people to successfully overthrow the time one of the most powerful empires in the world, the French Empire, and kind of produce a moment of a first Black Republic. So you see clearly in Robinson's readings of people like Du Bois and C.L.R. James and also Richard Wright's writings on blues, a real close attention to culture and spirituality as part of what makes possible Black agency, the Black radical tradition at different moments in history, and therefore part of what we should be attentive to today if we want to continue to mobilize that tradition in the present.
That's the voice of Yusuf al-Balushi. You can find a spelling of his name on againstthegrain.org. He is assistant professor of global and international studies at the University of California, Irvine. He's working on a book examining the afterlife of apartheid geographies in Durban, South Africa. We are talking about an article he wrote about the thought of Cedric Robinson and the intellectual geography of that thought. It was published in the journal GeoForum. We have a link to that as well on our site, againstthegrain.org. Cedric Robinson, again, the political scientist and Black studies scholar who wrote, among other things, the book Black Marxism. Cedric Robinson lived from 1940 to 2016 and taught at UC Santa Barbara for over three decades, beginning in 1978. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. There's much more in this article than we can cover this hour, but something else that Robinson engaged with was a field of study called world systems analysis. That engagement with that field, you write, shaped Cedric Robinson's theory of racial capitalism. In a nutshell, difficult question, but in a nutshell, what is world systems approach? What was it trying to privilege or foreground, let's say, in contrast to, I think, a pretty typical focus of the social sciences on the nation state?
So world systems analysis arguably emerges in the 1960s and 1970s. This is a moment of tremendous global upheaval. And at the forefront of this upheaval are the anti-colonial revolutions. It's the emergence of the third world onto the global stage of political economic actions, which represents a dramatic transformation in global capitalism's 500-year history that was dominated by European empires from the start, beginning with the Spanish and Portuguese empires. And world systems analysis emerges at this time in conversation with a number of other kind of budding theoretical frameworks that are also trying to understand this shift and, in a sense, to advise some of the recently decolonized countries for how they can act and develop and confront the challenges of global capitalism. So usually when we hear the story of this field of thought, we think of it as a subfield, usually in sociology, and we associate it most often with the Fernand Braudel Center at SUNY Binghamton that was established in the mid-1970s. And we trace, therefore, the lineage of this framework back to certain French historians like Fernand Braudel and others who were a part of the Annales school of historians, people like Marc Bloch and Lucien Febvre, who were trying to come to grips with long-term patterns in history. They were trying to understand what the underlying structural constraints were to any given historical period in human history. And they wanted to place greater emphasis on those structural constraints than they did to kind of the changes that we observed in news articles and even some of our scholarship that were happening on a more short-term basis, but which they said were kind of surface reflections that ignored the long-term structural constraints. So they developed this notion of the longue durée, both to understand periods of time like a long century that extends backwards and forwards into other centuries. And they wanted to understand what governed global capitalism. And so this term world system becomes, in a sense, their term for global capitalism, a single integrated world system, a single integrated world economy, which they argued was new in human history, because up to that point, you had more regional forms of integration. And in order to come to grips with this integrated single world system, they argued, as you pointed out, we had to shift the unit of analysis in dominant forms of social scientific research. The nation state had been the preeminent unit of analysis, which is to say, if you wanted to understand the history of a particular society, you took this artificial formulation of a nation state, you said, we live in France, and I'm going to do French history. And if you wanted to understand something going on in the Caribbean in the late 1700s or early 1800s, let's say Haiti, you created this artificial construct known as Haiti, and you looked at the history of that particular society, the politics of that particular society. Now, in some senses, in order to say anything meaningful, of course, we have to create these divisions, and we have to break up human history into categories that are more easy to manage. But world system scholars argued that doing that unfortunately blinded us more than it revealed to us the actual goings on and the histories and social makeup of these different societies, and that we had to understand the history of the French Revolution, for example, in dialogue with, in conversation with the history of the Haitian Revolution, that you couldn't understand the development of French political economy up until the French Revolution without understanding plantation slavery, the centrality of the slave trade, the centrality of sugar cultivation in a place like Saint-Domingue to the budding French Industrial Revolution, and the ways that all of those debates around slavery also impacted political theorists developing a notion of the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Man, and vice versa, that in order to understand the Haitian Revolution, we had to understand what was going on in France. So they make an argument to shift the unit of analysis from nation states to an integrated but uneven world system as a whole. That's one of their big interventions. And they're building off of the dependency school of thinkers, many of whom emerged in Latin America in the 1950s, in the 1960s, as advisors to new governments who were all seeking to develop their economies, but who found that mainstream economic advice for how they could develop their societies and countries didn't seem to work, right? The mainstream capitalist advice of people like Walter Rostow, the stages of growth, didn't seem to work for them. And they began to argue that that was the case because of a dependency of peripheral countries, satellite countries, upon the metropole, former colonizing countries. So even though we were witnessing an anti-colonial revolution around the world, and countries were winning what was later referred to as flag independence, because of this single integrated world system that was a fundamentally uneven system, some of these recently independent countries found it quite difficult to develop. And so they developed their own economic theories that could advise governments, things like import substitution and industrialization, that would take into account this relationship of dependency and would provide an alternative path forward for those societies. So world systems builds on that framework. They refer to this unevenness in the world system as a relationship between core production processes and peripheral production processes. We tend to simplify that referring to core countries and peripheral countries, but they have argued that you can have both those processes in the same, a single country. It's just a question of which one dominates. And they pushed back against the fracturing of the social sciences into discrete disciplines of history over here, sociology over here, economics over there, political science over there, and argued that we also had to unite the social sciences in order to develop a better understanding of the world system as a whole.
Yusuf al-Baluchi, Assistant Professor of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Irvine. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Yeah, and what we've been talking about, you know, to some degree this hour is the way in which Cedric Robinson engaged with Africa and looked to Africa and analyzed Africa. You know, the extent to which Africa really played a large role in his thinking about politics and especially culture. What about the world systems analysis school? Did they look to Africa in any significant way for answers, for insights?
Indeed, they did. And this is not spoken about enough, I would argue, in genealogies of the world system school of thinkers. A number of the founders of the most prominent kind of founders of this field began their work as either Africans, in the case of Samir Amin, or as Africanists, in the case of people like Giovanni Arrighi and Emmanuel Wallerstein. Wallerstein's first two books were about the anti-colonial revolution in Africa and the politics of independent governments. He met Frantz Fanon and became close enough to him that he was by his bedside in Maryland when he passed away from leukemia in 1961. Giovanni Arrighi was trained as an economist and worked in Southern Africa, was central in kind of politically active in getting arms to some of the liberation movements in places like Rhodesia, had to flee Rhodesia as a result of it, and ended up in Dar es Salaam, the University of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania in the 1960s, when it was just becoming the kind of center for global Pan-African thinking, and maybe arguably the most important center of intellectual radical work in the African continent. People like Walter Rodney were there and were colleagues of Giovanni Arrighi, John Saul, who he co-authored a couple of books with. The great Africanist Mahmoud Mamdani was there, Marjorie Mbilinyi, Ruth First did a stint teaching at the University of Dar es Salaam. Many, many people who went on to become extremely important were there at this time. And so when we think of this world systems analysis emphasis upon understanding a single integrated world economy rather than discrete nation states, we need to think of debates that were happening at the University of Dar es Salaam around how to decolonize a university curriculum that had been inherited from colonial times, and debates around a single mandatory social science course on development that these scholars were involved with designing at the time, and trying to integrate politics with economics, with sociology, with history into a single framework. Walter Rodney was central to those efforts and those arguments. And they had many fights, bitter fights, with more conservative and mainstream scholars who wanted to stick to the traditional kind of European colonial mode of doing things in the course of developing such courses. So it's clear that Africa played a central role in some of these thinkers' development as thinkers. And indeed, Arrighi said at one point, this is a point that Derlugian makes in an article about Arrighi, that it was easier to understand what was going on in the richest countries of the world, in Europe, the core countries, from the vantage point of Africa. You could see the whole better from Africa than you could from the metropolitan countries and their great institutions in Europe. So that fits very much in line with a kind of third worldism that Cedric Robinson was certainly a part of, and the debates that many of these societies were undergoing included that of the role of the peasantry in the new political revolutions and new economies. If Marxism as a theory had been centered around the working class, and capitalism talks about the need to industrialize and develop this waged working class, what do you do in a society that is overwhelmingly comprised not of a proletariat, but of a peasantry? These were the kinds of questions they were asking themselves. What does capitalism look like in those spaces? Do we see a kind of articulation between different modes of production that aren't historically discrete? Feudalism, or what Amin called a tributary mode of production, and capitalism on the other hand, but do they articulate and overlap in some of these societies, requiring different policies on the part of these new liberation governments? So those debates that were going on in Africa were certainly central to the development of world systems.
Yusuf al-Balushi, you can find on againstthegrain.org a link to his faculty page at UC Irvine, where he teaches in the Department of Global and International Studies, as well as a link to an article he wrote that is served as the basis for today's conversation. It's called Thinking Racial Capitalism and Black Radicalism from Africa, an Intellectual Geography of Cedric Robinson's World System, published in the journal GeoForum. Yusuf, thanks for your work, for the clarity of your writing, and for the clarity of your presentation today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, CS. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.